You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Christian Kotz is the Director of Education and Visitor Engagement at James Madison's Montpelier and has been with the foundation for 15 years. He is responsible for the creation, implementation, and oversight of all Montpelier guided tours, hands-on experiences, student programs, interpretive signage, and many exhibits. Listen as Mr. Kotz tells the story of Montpelier and its most famous resident, President James Madison. Mr. Kotz spoke at the Wednesday, May 13, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Vice President John McCauley. Our podcast is entitled simply Montpelier. Here's John McCauley.
We're very pleased today to be able to present a program about Montpelier, and this is something we've looked forward to. It's something about our area that's really significant. And I don't know if you have visited Montpelier much recently, but it seems like every time my wife and I go out there, there's something new, there's something different. It's pretty exciting and it's interesting, and we learn a lot about history. And Christian Kotz is our speaker today. He is the Director of Education and Visitor Engagement at Montpelier, and he's been with the foundation there for about 15 years. He's responsible for the creation, implementation, and oversight of all guided tours there, hands-on experiences, student programs, interpretive signage, and many exhibits. So I think he has a pretty hefty job. James Madison, you know, was called a little man, but in history, the history of our country, he's a great man. He's a very, very special person. And you know much about the Constitution. It's been in the news in recent months and years. He had a lot to do with that. Also with the establishment of the nation itself in the early days. And so we want to hear about that. We also want to hear about the extensive work being done at Montpelier and not just the house, but everything else that goes with it. So let's welcome Christian, and we'll have time for questions after this. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Can everybody hear me? I wanted to point out Joanne Powell, who's in the crowd, who's one of our wonderful interpreters at Montpelier, who has been there as long as I have, haven't you? We're some of the last of the Mohicans there. So I've been at Montpelier for 15 years. I started in 2000, coming right out of graduate school, and ran the children's education side of things for numerous years before I took over the adult education as well, and all the other stuff John was talking about. So I've been there a long time, seen a lot of changes. It was a great big pink house when I started, and now it looks a whole lot better. So let's see. So first and foremost, Montpelier is a home. It was home to three generations of the Madisons, starting with Madison's grandfather, Ambrose, in the 1720s, then passing to Ambrose's widow, Frances, James's grandmother, then to James's father, James Madison Sr., and then to James Madison Jr., our president, in 1801. It was also home to our first lady, Dolly Madison, who was also Montpelier's owner after the time Madison died and until she sold it in 1844. And it was home to some 300 enslaved people who lived at Montpelier over the course of the Madison tenure. And it was home to the DuPont family, who radically altered Montpelier in the 20th century. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's more than a home. It's a place of inspiration. At Montpelier, Madison conceived ideas about self-government that would change the course of human history. Today, Montpelier showcases the retirement era home and community that James Madison lived in and amongst, and broadcasts that inspiration that he found outward. Our mission is to inspire continuing public engagement with American constitutional self-government by bringing to life the home and contributions of James and Dolly Madison. So let's begin with James, our fourth president, father of the Constitution, architect of the Bill of Rights. Madison was born at Montpelier in 1751. He was the first of his parents' 12 children. He would grow up in his grandparents' house. His father hadn't built the beginnings of the brick mansion yet. And at an early age, he showed an aptitude for learning. By the time he was 10 or 11, he had read through all of the 100 books that his father owned, and his parents decided they would invest some of their money in his education. So they sent him first to Donald Robertson's private boarding school, which was out on the Northern Neck. He lived there for about 6 years, studying with Donald Robertson, who was a new immigrant from Scotland and a Presbyterian minister and a pretty serious taskmaster. They studied from sunup to sundown 6 days a week, and they went to church all day on Sunday. Now imagine doing that from the time you're 11 until you're 16. How much fun would that be? But when he came out of that school, he could read in 6 different languages. He had studied the classics, mathematics, geography, geometry, all that stuff. And he studied at home with a private tutor for about 2 years before deciding to go to college at the College of New Jersey, which we know today as Princeton. At Princeton, Madison would receive an excellent Enlightenment education, learning about the principles of science and reason and logic and applying them at Princeton to principles of self-government and to principles of freedom of conscience. Now, this is during the time of the Intolerable Acts, when the British Parliament is passing the Intolerable Acts against the colonies. And the kids at Princeton are caught up in all of this. Being at Princeton in 1769 was like being in Berkeley in 1969, okay? They were wearing black to protest British government actions. They were burning British tax collectors in effigy from the lampposts on campus, and they were debating principles of self-government amongst themselves. This is where he would learn to debate, this is where he would learn to argue, and this is where he would learn to analyze in accord with the scientific method. And by the time he was done at Princeton, he had picked up his 7th language, which was Hebrew. This will become very important later, but I mean, basically by the time this guy is out of college, he can read anything in print in the Western world, right? But like any good liberal arts major, when he was done with college, he had absolutely no idea what to do with himself, nor had he studied to become much of anything. Luckily, he was daddy's first boy, so he didn't really have to. He knew he would get the plantation one day if he wanted it. So he goes home, and events transpire over the next few years that will lead to the Revolution, and Madison will become involved in politics. He's in the Governor's Council. He is in the Virginia Legislature. He's part of the Continental Congress. He helps draft the Articles of Confederation. He serves in the Confederation Congress, then to the Constitutional Convention, then to the House of Representatives, then Secretary of State, and then finally as President. And through that political career, Madison would become a champion for an idea that he picked up on in Princeton, that of religious freedom, what he called the freedom of conscience. This began really in Orange when the Baptists, this is before he even gets involved in politics, the Baptists are being persecuted by the Anglican establishment. And Madison goes to their aid. He finds their inability to practice their own religion is at odds with the principles of the Enlightenment that he'd learned about. And so, not in any formal way, but by writing and meeting with people, talking to people, he becomes a spokesman for the Baptists. And though he doesn't know it and it's not intentional, what he's doing is building a constituency. And when he does run for office in a few years, he'll find those people remember him and help elect him into the legislature. So when he gets there in Williamsburg in 1776, he's immediately put on the committee that is drafting the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which is headed up by George Mason. Mason is a revered statesman. Madison's 25 years old. But Mason calls for the toleration of different religious sects in Virginia. And Madison says, you know what? What the government says it will tolerate, it can choose not to tolerate. And so he makes Mason change the language of the Virginia Declaration to the free exercise of religion. About 10 years later, he'll battle Patrick Henry in the state assembly when Patrick Henry is trying to get Virginians to pay for the Anglican establishment. He'll write the Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments, and then passes Thomas Jefferson's Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom through the assembly, pushes it through the assembly is a better way to phrase that. So he defeats Patrick Henry at that time, just 35 years old. And then, of course, later, a few years later, he will pen the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights, and the first clause of the First Amendment will call for religious freedom. To Madison, religious freedom was the freedom of conscience. It was the freedom for people to think without government interference. It was not about going to whatever church you wanted to. It was the ability to think freely. And from that, Madison thought, stemmed all of our other rights, right? What good is the freedom of the press without the freedom of thought? His political career that kind of took off in the 1780s with the Constitutional Convention would span 40 years and five decades. This guy was as big a part of American society as John Wayne was in the 20th century, okay? He was a fixture of American politics. By the time he retired, he was already considered the father of the Constitution and the architect of the Bill of Rights. He was known throughout the land as the co-author of the Federalist Papers and the author of the Virginia Resolutions. He was a busy guy in that retirement era. He kind of became America's sage, if you will. By 1830, he was the last of the founders left living. And that second generation of American statesmen came to Montpelier seeking his advice, or they wrote to him at Montpelier seeking his advice. So these are guys like Daniel Webster, Henry Clay, Andrew Jackson, even in some respects John Quincy Adams. So he even after he retires, his fingers are reaching out into America and guiding American politics. I like to think of the... If you all remember the cover of The Godfather, the puppet, right? Madison had a gift for being the puppet master. He could do so much more behind the scenes. And his years as an executive weren't fabulous. They weren't his shining moment. But doing things behind the scenes, he excelled at. So he had other things to do in his retirement. A lot of people in this town unfortunately forget that he helped Thomas Jefferson found that little state school that's down the road here, and actually served as its rector for 8 years after Jefferson's death, and actually hosted meetings of the Board of Visitors at Montpelier on a number of occasions. He was also a founding member of the American Colonization Society, which sought to buy the freedom of slaves in America and send them to Liberia to colonize that country. Sort of a naive attempt, I think, at trying to ameliorate the conditions of slavery. And most importantly, in his retirement era, in the retirement era, Madison worked on his notes on the Federal Convention. Sorry, I lost track of my slides here. he had taken the best set of notes during the Constitutional Convention, but the delegates had all agreed amongst themselves that those notes taken by anyone were not to be published until every last man present had died, right? The Constitution that they came up with in 1787 was an experiment. Nobody was really sure that it was going to work, and if it went bad, none of those guys wanted the finger coming back and pointing at them by their constituents, right? They knew there would be some sort of government, and they didn't want to lose their jobs. So the proceedings of the convention would be secret till every last man had died. Madison spends much of the 1820s and 30s writing out those notes in longhand so they could be published. Dolley sells them to a publisher, sells them to Congress, actually, on Madison's death. And they've been published here and there. They're not, you know, a bestseller. They're not on the Pulitzer list. They're sort of a cure for insomnia, but they are the absolute best record for us to know how our government was created. All of the debates, all of the conversations are in those notes. So it's sort of like the making of documentary of the Constitution. And we have Madison to thank for that. They are out of print again. But you can find their entire text on our website at www.context.montpelier.org. And they're pretty cool. They're annotated by scholars on the website, so you see more than just the 18th century writing. You see modern scholars' comments on what was happening during the debates. Madison would die at Montpelier in 1836 at 85 years old, and was buried in the family cemetery under a simple fieldstone. This granite obelisk wasn't put up until about 15 years after he had died. It's visited every March on his birthday by the United States Marine Corps, who lay a wreath at the grave, which is provided by the President of the United States, which is a very moving ceremony I invite all of you to come see sometime. We are the only presidential site that has the Marine Corps come, because the Marines consider Madison kind of their creator. He was the one who argued in their favor during the Barbary Wars while he was Secretary of State. So Montpelier is also the home of our dearest Dolley, America's first lady. Dolley grew up in North Carolina, or she was born in North Carolina, grew up in Virginia, until Dad sold the plantation and moved the family to Philadelphia. There she married a Quaker lawyer named John Todd. They had two kids, and if the story had a happy ending, we never would have heard of Dolley. But yellow fever hit Philadelphia in 1793, leaving her a widow with a small son named John Payne Todd. Less than a year later, she was introduced to Madison by that great American rascal, Aaron Burr, who had been classmates with Madison at Princeton. They met in May, they were engaged in June, and they were married in September, very happily for the next 42 years. They had a great, loving relationship. She called him, picking up on something John said earlier. John was talking about how we think of him as a little man, but he did great things. Well, Dolley called him the great little Madison. Dolley would become Madison's best political asset. Peter Onuf, a professor at UVA here, called Dolley the go-to, go-through gal of Washington. Okay, and in the early years, she served in a fashion as Jefferson's first lady, since he was a widower, and then took over as first lady herself formally when Madison got the presidency. So she was in the White House for 16 years. She was probably better known to most Americans than either Madison or Jefferson. Everyone wanted to know who Dolley was inviting to the White House, what she was serving, what kind of curtain she was buying, what kind of china she was buying. She was hugely popular with the American public. And she had a gift for bringing people from opposing sides together and helping them to find compromise. So when Madison couldn't get something done in the Oval Office, he would invite the two different parties to dinner and seat them on either side of Dolly and say, don't let them leave the table until they've found a compromise. And because she wielded so much political power in Washington, neither of those guys who were arguing wanted to disappoint Dolly, right? Because they knew they were going to need a favor in the future. And so Dolly was really adept at making things happen. She really helped shape American political culture in the first few years of the nation's history. And like I said, she wielded enormous political power. I missed my slides again. I'm sorry. That's the statue in the backyard. See, they're together in all kinds of weather. There's our montage of Dolly. You know, Dolly also suffered from all the dirty politics that we see today. We shouldn't think that politics in the early 19th century was any different. She was accused of having an affair with Jefferson. They kind of dragged her through the mud in the papers all the time. So Montpelier was also home to the enslaved community. As I said, there were about 300 people who lived at Montpelier over the course of the Madison ownership from 1723 to 1844. We can track, we think, six generations of families through the enslaved community. There's actually one enslaved woman's name that comes up, and through research we've been able to figure out that there's a Millie, daughter of 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 Millie, six times, beginning in the 1720s and going through the 1840s. It's the enslaved community that will make Montpelier function, right? They will provide the labor, they will provide the hospitality, they will provide the income that allows Madison to follow a life of public service. We know a great deal about one of them, one of those 300, Paul Jennings, who was Madison's butler towards the end of his life. Paul would actually get his freedom in the 1840s. He was not freed by James or Dolly, but he did get his freedom, and would write a memoir of his time with James Madison, which is very interesting reading. But about the other 299 people, we know virtually nothing. Sometimes we have a runaway ad. Sometimes we see mentions of them in letters. But for the most part, we have just a name, if that. Then came the DuPonts, right? The house passed through six different owners between 1844 and 1901. In the years after the Civil War, a 5,000-acre plantation, a 12,000-square-foot house, no slaves, no tractors. How do you deal with that? So ownership passed rapidly at Montpelier until came the DuPonts, who had more money than God, and chose to... They were a family of four when they bought the place in 1901, and the 12,000-square-foot house just wasn't big enough. So they're going to add 25,000 square feet to it, and continued the stuccoing that was done to the house in the 1850s. But then they painted that stucco a salmon color, giving us the house that you might remember from the 20th century. The last DuPont was Marion DuPont Scott, who had married movie actor Randolph Scott. She had a huge equestrian influence on Montpelier, and they built the flat track course and the steeplechase course under her tenure there. She left Montpelier to the National Trust for Historic Preservation when she died in 1984, and the trust has owned the property ever since. At that time, the property was 2,650 acres, so it had shrunk considerably since Madison's time. It is still 2,650 acres. It's bigger than Monticello. But it wasn't Madison's house. And so what everybody wanted to do, of course, was return Montpelier to the way it looked in the Madison's time. About 15 years later, we secured a gift of $22 million from the estate of Paul Mellon, and we began the four-year restoration campaign where we basically took the shell off the turtle, right? We pulled off all the DuPont additions and returned it to the way it looked in Madison's time. And we only stopped giving tours for 2 weeks, right, Joanne? We actually had people going through the house with hard hats on that we gave them. And it was actually a really fun time to do tours because it was like a skeletal home, right? There were no walls left. We had pulled out all the plaster. It was the most cutting-edge and accurate restoration of a 19th-century presidential home ever accomplished, and it will be a textbook example of historic preservation for years to come, and employed some of the best craftsmen from around the country. Oh, so that's the way it looked in 2008 when we first opened. And that was 3,000 screaming fourth and fifth graders to make that flag. And you would not believe what it took to get them to stand in those lines while the Supreme Court Justice talked and talked and talked and talked. Okay, but the restoration wasn't complete, right? That 22 million bucks, those 4 years got us a house. It got us plaster on the walls, it got us floors, it got us some paint in some rooms, but it didn't get us wallpaper, it didn't get us carpets, it didn't get us furniture, it didn't get us artwork, and all that was still to do. So we began what we called the Presidential Detective Story, which was the campaign to refurnish and restore the interior spaces. What sorts of chairs did they have? What kind of curtains did they have? What kind of carpets, wallpaper, artwork? Unlike another founder who will remain nameless, Madison did not write down everything in triplicate. And so the detective work to figure this stuff out really is detective work, and it takes an incredible amount of digging and of doing research to figure out where to find stuff and what it should have looked like. This is the drawing room. We've completed about six rooms. We have the drawing room, the dining room, two libraries, and the study, and a new bedchamber will be unveiled next week. So about half the house has been refurnished with another half left to go. Let's see. Books, documents. So we are aided in that research by the archaeology department. We have a fabulous archaeology department, very engaged in public archaeology. Our archaeologists love talking to people while they work. You can actually pay them to come out and dig for them. They'll let you do that. Costs a couple of $100 and you can go there for a week and dig. It's a great experience. You'll learn lots. But the archaeological record is literally just below the surface of the ground. In some instances, you can dig your heel into the dirt and come up with an artifact. Just the other day, we were taking a group of kids through the side yard and doing an educational program with them where they were sitting in the grass, and one kid was sitting there, you know, scuffing his heels on the ground, and lo and behold, he bends down and he said, "Look at this," and it's an arrowhead, right? So, I mean, even going back before the Madisons, that archaeological record is just right there. And they help us by finding not just, you know, in this instance, they're looking at the homes of the enslaved community, which tells us about their lives. But for instance, they found the head of a pawn, right, that was in the backyard that told us what kind of chess set Madison played on. And we were able to acquire an exact match to that chess set from England. We're finding their ceramics, right? What kind of dishes did the Madisons serve their dinners on? What sort of earthenware or stoneware jars were they storing things in? So the archaeological record is really important. Both of these initiatives got a huge catalyst, I guess you could say, last fall when we were lucky enough to receive a $10 million gift. Sorry, I'm bad with my slides again. More archaeology. We got a $10 million gift from David Rubenstein, who is a huge patriotic philanthropist and who supports all sorts of great American history endeavors. That gift will be transformative at Montpelier. In the next 5 years, we plan to research and refurnish 6 more spaces inside the mansion, and we will create a groundbreaking exhibit on slavery that will run throughout the cellar spaces of the mansion, which is a huge amount of square footage. And we will entirely excavate and reconstruct the South Yard domestic slave community area. So that will involve excavating 6 sites, which you can see in that picture there. Is there a laser? Oh, cool. Let's see. Is it going to work? No. I don't know. All right. So there are 3 duplex slave quarters there that you're seeing, 2 smokehouses, and a kitchen house. So all of those will be excavated and then entirely reconstructed within the next few years. That South Yard complex is like 30 feet off of the corner of the mansion. So it will entirely change your perspective of Montpelier. When you see those structures there, their mass and their presence really helps you to realize how many other people lived at Montpelier and worked for the Madisons. The Center for the Constitution, you may have heard of the Center for the Constitution. They're sort of our outreach arm at Montpelier. They seek to provide nonpartisan education about the Constitution and constitutional issues. And they focus on people who are sort of regular end users of the Constitution. Of course, we all use the Constitution in our everyday lives, whether we know it or not, whether we realize it or not. But we're talking about people like teachers, journalists, cops, judges, congressmen. We've had groups of state Supreme Court judges come and take courses at the center. I had to give a tour for Sandra Day O'Connor. Talk about nerve-wracking, trying to talk about the Constitution with Sandra Day O'Connor. But the center has touched 35,000 people to date from all 50 states and representatives from 85 countries. They also run the We the People program, which is a high school level curriculum that teachers can choose to involve themselves in, where they study all year long to go to a competition at the end of the year where they sit in a courtroom at a table in front of a bench of judges and debate another team on constitutional principles. It is really, really astounding to witness. The kids really put their heart and soul into it, and I guarantee you they know more about the Constitution than a lot of us who have studied it for years. It's really cool to see. And it's a national competition. They have people from all 50 states who take part. The center's also begun to take on an international reputation. And in the last few years, we've had delegations from Zimbabwe, Bhutan, and Sri Lanka stay on site with us and learn from the scholars at the center as they debate their own forms of self-government in their own countries. This is an image from the what we call the YALI Institute this summer, President Obama's initiative to take young African leaders. They spent about 3 weeks in Virginia learning about principles of self-government, and they spent a week with us staying on site at Montpelier. That was a really neat group to be part of. Today, we have all kinds of tours for you to come on. We have our standard signature tour, which is about an hour long, but we also have 90-minute and 2-hour-long tours that are in-depth and that focus on subjects like Madison and slavery, Madison and the Constitution, and Dolley and the women of Montpelier. There are numerous exhibits in the mansion and the visitor center to explore. We see about 6,000 kids every year come on field trips, which are It's really encouraging to see. We offer nature programs. We offer hands-on cooking and hands-on tool demonstrations. We have 5 miles of walking trails on the property. And lest you think it's all about the early Republic at Montpelier, we also have a reconstructed Civil War Confederate camp. When Robert E. Lee was defeated at Gettysburg, he retreated to Orange and created what they called the Rapidan Line, which was his defensive line, which went through Montpelier and which is where the Army of Northern Virginia camped from about August till or November till May over the winter of 1864. They pretty much packed up their bags from this camp and walked right into the wilderness. So for a lot of these guys, this was the last place they stayed. So we've recreated that to talk about sort of the legacy of the Constitution, if you will. And right next to the Civil War camp is the home of an emancipated slave that was built in the Reconstruction era. George Gilmore was born a slave in 1810 to the Madisons and would build this home in the 1870s and live there. His family lived there into the 1920s. And then pushing it even a step further, we have the 1910 segregated train station that William DuPont built so that he didn't have to drive the 4 miles into Orange to catch the train. Right? He wanted the train to stop at Montpelier. So taking the idea of citizenship or interpreting the idea of citizenship into the 20th century with Jim Crow and segregation. And then, of course, you can't forget the first Saturday in November are the Montpelier Hunt Races. And that's always a good time. But before I wrap up, I just wanted to go into a little bit more detail about the most important thing about Montpelier. There are a historian talked about hinge points in history, right, where things radically change, and not just for one group of people, but for everybody. So a hinge point in history. And what happened at Montpelier in 1786 was a hinge point in history. And I think it's one of the, I think it's the reason that sets Montpelier apart, even if most people don't realize it, from other historic homes or presidential homes, because something actually happened at Montpelier. It wasn't a big event. Nobody died. It didn't make the newspapers. But ideas were conceived at Montpelier, right? In 1786, Madison has just defeated Patrick Henry, right? He's just passed Jefferson's statute for religious freedom. He's got to be high as a kite, right? He's 35 years old. He writes a letter to Jefferson where he says, "I flatter myself to think that never again will a law be made that governs the human mind." Okay? Those are big words. And, you know, in the subtext, he's saying, and I did that, right? You wrote the language, but I got it through. Okay? So now he's thinking, what else can I do? What can I do next? Well, that federal government, it's kind of screwy, right? Let's see if we can't do something to fix that. And so he goes back to his father's home, and he's got a library of about 1,000 books with him that he's traveling around with. And he parks himself in the upstairs bedroom in Dad's house. It might have been his bedroom growing up as a kid. We don't really know. But he parks himself in that room for about 6 months, and he barely comes out. His family members write about him, only like poking his head downstairs for dinner and then going right back upstairs. He's just totally sequestered up there. And what's he doing? He is studying all the past attempts at self-government, okay? He writes to Jefferson, who's in France, and says, "I need you to send me every book you can find on past attempts at self-government, about philosophy, and about political theory," right? Now that's like giving candy to a kid with Jefferson, right? He gets to go book shopping on his buddy's dime in France. So Jefferson sends him 250 books from France. Remember, Madison can read in 7 different languages, okay? Madison calls it his literary cargo. And he analyzes every past attempt at self-government that had happened in the last 2,000 years, okay? And in a very scientific way, remember he had studied the scientific method, remember that Enlightenment education, he analyzes them all. And he says, here's what they did, here's what was good, here's what was bad, here's why it went wrong. He lays out all these different experiments, and then he writes an essay kind of coalescing it all called Notes on Ancient and Modern Confederacies, and then he looks at our own system of government under the Articles of Confederation. And he does the same thing. Why, how it was created, what's good about it, what's bad about it, why is it failing, right? And then he writes an essay about that called Vices of the Political System of the United States. So according to the scientific method, he's gone through all these different experiments. He's looked at them all. The next thing to do is hypothesize, right? So how can we create a government that can govern the people, right? He's looking out at the Blue Ridge at this fantastic view from his window. How can we govern the people in silk stockings on the cobbled streets of Boston and those people down in the mountains of Virginia and the swamps of Georgia under one government, right? How can we make this work? And he starts to develop ideas about the idea of the extended republic. He develops ideas about factions. He synthesizes 2,000 years of political theory, taking the best from everybody. He's looking at Thomas Aquinas. He's looking at Calvin. He's looking at John Locke. He's looking at John Adams, okay? Montesquieu, Voltaire, all of this is being synthesized in his brain. And he comes up with some ideas, and then he starts to travel around. He bounces to Richmond, to Williamsburg, to Philadelphia, to Mount Vernon, to New York, and eventually lands in Philadelphia again about 2 weeks before the Constitutional Convention. And he cements those ideas down on paper in the form of 15 very simple resolutions that become known as the Virginia Plan. And it's that plan that's taken as the starting point for the Constitutional Convention a few weeks later. And they argue it, and they change it, and they hash it around, and Madison's pulling his hair out. But by the end of September, what comes out of the Constitutional Convention is largely the same thing that he proposed in the Virginia Plan. Now, it's not over yet, right? Because now the Constitution has to be ratified. The people have to ratify this document. Probably one of the only times in history a people have voted into power their government, certainly the first time in history it ever happened. And that moment at the ratification is probably that hinge point. But back to that in a minute. So Madison will fight hard for ratification. He stays in New York for a while, helping Hamilton write the Federalist Papers to convince New York to go along, because if New York doesn't go along, nobody's going to go along. Then he goes to Virginia. Once he knows he's got New York in his pocket, he goes to Virginia and fights Patrick Henry again and George Mason and James Monroe at the time and convinces Virginia to sign. And, of course, the big thing that everybody's worried about is the fact that the Constitution doesn't have a Bill of Rights, right? They need government protection. Madison didn't agree initially. He thought the Constitution laid out the powers of government, and whatever powers aren't granted in the Constitution, the government doesn't have. Now, that's probably a naive point of view. Eventually, he was convinced that a Bill of Rights would be a good idea, and so he writes one. He says, "Vote me into Congress, and I'll write you a Bill of Rights." And he's good to his word. And in the first session of Congress, he introduces 17 amendments that he pens. The House passes the 17. The Senate passes 12. They're sent to the states for ratification, and the states ratify the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, what we know as the Bill of Rights. Interestingly enough, one of his amendments that didn't get passed became the 27th Amendment in the 1990s about how the Congress can give itself a raise, which doesn't surprise anyone that it took 200 years to pass. But anyway, going back to the idea of the hinge point, when the Constitution was ratified, that was a hinge point in history, right? Never again did human society think about government the same way. That changed the world. Now, it took a little while. But today, just 225 years later, half the world's population lives under some form of self-government, right? And all of those people, whether we're in Virginia or Texas or Seattle or Tunisia or Egypt or India, right? All of those people, all of those movements owe a debt of gratitude to the thinking that Madison did and the ideas that he conceived at Montpelier. The end.
Well, thank you, Christian. We're now going to take questions. I'm sure you must have some. And please raise your hand, and somebody will bring a microphone to you. And then Christian will try to address those.
Christian, you talked about 300 people living in Montpelier. And then you showed six, and you mentioned four of them were houses.
Right.
Were there more slave
quarters? Oh, yeah, lots more.
And about how many would you estimate?
I don't think I could begin to estimate the number of quarters that were at Montpelier. What you saw in the image of the what we call the South Yard, there were three duplex quarters there, right? So three houses each divided in half, a family living in either side of each duplex. We estimate that there were between 20 and 30 people living in that South Yard area. They were only the domestic servants. Those are the maids, the butlers, the cooks, the seamstress, the laundress, the footmen, errand runners. There was a whole nother complex of buildings that we know about where the skilled artisans would have been, the blacksmith, the carpenters, the wheelwrights, the leather workers, the carriage, repair guys. We haven't fully excavated that area yet. And then there were numerous field quarter complexes across the 5,000 acres. And we have no idea how many of those there were. Those would have just been log cabins, right, with probably just a brick hearth, if that, with a stick and mud chimney on the outside. So they leave virtually no footprint until they are excavated. And we have to know where to look to excavate them. So we're getting there. We have the South Yard, and we know about. The craft complex is slated to be excavated in probably 5 or 6 years. There's a field quarter complex, which is just over the hill from the visitor center, where we've discovered a half dozen different quarters, and there's probably more there. They'll probably get back to that in 4 or 5 years. So there's a lot to do. Our director of archaeology has been at Montpelier as long as I have, and he's got job security for the rest of his life.
Thank you.
Sure.
What is your most favorite part about working at Montpelier, and could you write a book about working there?
Yeah, I don't know if anybody would want to read it. favorite part about working at Montpelier. Oh, geez. I think what's great about Montpelier has been the fact that there are so many different facets of history to talk about that are all really exciting and interesting to me. I mean, you've got the president, you've got a secretary of state, you've got the founding, you've got the Constitution, you've got freedom of religion, which I love that whole bit. You've got the plantation aspect and slavery. You've got Reconstruction, Civil War, segregation. I mean, it just keeps you on your toes, and it makes you need to know so much. And I think the other thing, too, is the fact that a lot of the research is yet to be done, which is challenging but also sort of inspiring. Our interpretation is always changing because it seems like almost every week, if not every day, we're finding something else out that makes us tweak the interpretation just a little bit, And with enough of those little bits, you start to realize, oh, it's not anything like I thought it was. It's now it's this. So that's also really engaging. And it's a beautiful place to be. You got to go to work somewhere every day. Montpelier is a pretty good place to have to drive into.
I just want to say that I enjoyed the program on Sunday evenings from Radio IQ of your weekly
Constitutional. Right.
That's really entertaining.
Yeah, that's Stuart Harris. He does a great job. Madison.
This was wonderful talk.
Thank you.
I'm going to throw one at you.
Okay.
Steve Barry has written a
fiction book, The Madison Key or The Madison Enigma or something like that. Can't remember the title, but it's fiction. And his the theme of the book was that there were notes that he took during the Constitutional Convention that the attendees decided to allow states' rights to any state who wanted to withdraw from the
Union. Uh-huh.
And that those notes either were hidden in the ice house or that Dolly, when she had them published after all, or did he have them published?
Dolly sold the notes after he died. Yeah.
And that that those notes were perhaps withdrawn from his records of the constitutional conversations.
Right.
And I don't know if anybody's ever asked you this at any other times that you've spoken, but the writer, it was fiction, but he also said, he debunked what he had said as part of the fiction, but he said there still was a theory, a rumor, whatever, that there were notes that they had come to a conclusion that a state could withdraw from the Union. Does that ever?
So people come to Montpelier all the time looking for that, for the stone in the ice house where they hid the notes. So apparently that book is fairly widely read.
It's the Lincoln myth.
Right. First I would say from a historical perspective, that Madison would have been the most important thing to James Madison was the union of the states. And he would not have agreed with violent secession, right? If it was a majority decision that some states leave, that would be one thing. But a violent secession of, like what we saw in 1861, would not have been okay with Madison. And he actually warned against it in his what we call his final advice to my country. He wrote the Joanne, how does it start? The if you give me the first two words, I can take it from there. Closest to my heart and deepest in my conviction, the wish closest to my heart and deepest in my conviction is that the union of the states be cherished and perpetuated. Let the open enemy be considered a serpent in the Garden of Eden, and let the disguised one be as a Pandora with her box open. Okay. To Madison, the union that he created was paramount above anything else and would not have been a fan of secession.
Pardon me. I was referring to the theory that the discussion among the attendees of the Constitutional Convention.
Oh, that somebody.
And that Lincoln, in fact, this is because of the title of the book, The Lincoln Myth, that Lincoln actually created the Union by ignoring some evidence that there had been.
As far as I know, there is no historical
that's
evidence
what I wanted to
support
to
that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. You bring up another interesting point, which is that in their retirement, Madison, being the historian that he was, realized that his legacy would be scrutinized. And they went to some lengths to edit his papers. And you can tell it's done in a number of different hands. And you can tell when Madison makes an edit that he doesn't want people to see, he strikes that word out. Like, you can't turn the paper over and say, what was that? But when his secretaries do it, it's just kind of a, you know, wisp of the pen that goes through a word. And you can start to see what he's deleting from the historical record. And certainly, they were getting rid of a lot of their personal papers and correspondence towards the end of their years because they didn't want to be scrutinized in that way. I think one of the most telling examples of that is the fact that Madison and Burr were classmates at Princeton. Burr had introduced Dolly to James, and then Burr was vice president while Madison was Secretary of State. And yet there is no extant correspondence between James Madison and Aaron Burr. Well, you know that's not possible, right? I mean, they wrote to each other about things they must have. But none of that survives because by the time Madison died, Burr was a persona non grata in American history, right? So we're going to just distance ourselves from that guy.
You mentioned just briefly trails in the woods, mm-hmm. hiking trails. Well, there's a feature about Montpelier that a lot of people don't know, and that is that one of the trails near to the mansion goes through an area that is old growth forest.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Which is unusual in the East. There yeah. aren't, in eastern United States, there are very few areas that the pioneers didn't cut down the trees.
Right.
And this area apparently Madison knew was old growth, never been cut, and he thought it was important. And that's a surprising thing because people of his generation mostly would never have thought such a thought.
It's a little bit of Montpelier myth there.
Okay, which, fill it in for me.
We have the what we call the landmark forest, which has been designated by the Nature Conservancy as an old-growth forest. Today, these days, an old-growth forest is anything that's over 100 years old. So while we have trees out there that are older than that, I mean, there are trees out there that we know go back to the 1600s. Mostly those trees are in areas like ravine type areas that you wouldn't try to log anyway because it would be too difficult. And what I think what we've found out in the last decade, I would say, is that in that area of the landmark forest, Madison did actually plow it and plant it on the flat surfaces where he could. But left the woodlots in between in the ravines. On the other hand, he was the president of the Albemarle Agricultural Society. It's kind of a tongue twister. And he did advocate the conservation of woodlands. He saw it as a natural resource that was being depleted too fast. He commented on how he could look out his front porch at the Blue Ridge and how it had been nearly deforested in his own lifetime. Right, I mean, there are all those tanneries popping up at the base of the Blue Ridge, and they're cutting down all the oak trees to provide the tannin for the tanning process. So he was concerned with the deforestation, and he did advocate scientific farming and conservation of natural resources. But that idea that that 200-acre chunk of property had never been logged is a little magical, you know, Montpelier past.
Go over there first, but I just want to make a comment myself about what a fantastic, interesting, informative presentation that you've given us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the government, today's paper has an excellent article by Hilda on the food at Montpelier, and she's a very good advertiser for your program. And then another little statement, one of my first elementary school students in Virginia history was Mike Quinn, who was your director.
So it sounds like without Dolly Madison, we might not have had a country, since she was at least for some events and some pieces of the puzzle, the ground, the common ground on which compromise could be made.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any such common ground left among us? Is there any infrastructure for that kind of common ground or any kind of common ground?
You mean in Washington today?
I mean, yeah, in the country.
Oh, I can't comment on modern stuff. My understanding of American politics ends about 1844, 49.
Shoot. My question's a little related to that, I guess. So was Madison effective primarily because he was a deep thinker, extremely well-educated, researched things and so forth, so the the power of his written arguments and so forth really won the day. How was he as just kind of, you know, like LBJ? This is sort of the same question. Was he willing to wheel and deal with people to make things happen and so forth and so on?
Oh, my God, yes. He was a great backroom politician. I mean, he excelled at it. He negotiated what they call the dinner table compromise, which is where he took in during Washington's administration, he brought Hamilton and Jefferson together over dinner and said, you know, Hamilton wanted the bank. Jefferson didn't want the bank. Jefferson wanted lower tax burdens for Virginia. Jefferson wanted the capital moved to somewhere in the South. And so Madison arranged that whole deal where Jefferson would support the idea of the National Bank, or at least not fight too hard against it, if they moved the capital to the banks of the Potomac. So he was constantly working behind the scenes. And I think that's really where he excelled. He excelled in the legislature where he could argue because he could write his arguments out beforehand. And he had such an analytical mind that he could come up with that response so quickly. When you look at his memorial and remonstrance against Patrick Henry, it is bomb-proof. It is it's a 15-point argument, and you can't stick a finger in it. You know, it is just so logical that you can't argue against it. And that's that. You know, he excelled at that. And then the backroom stuff. It when he took over as executive, he didn't have a bad presidency. He saw the United States through its first conflict, you know, with the War of 1812. And he certainly left a more popular president than he entered, and won re-election, you know, at the time, during the war. So, you know, he wasn't a bad president, but it just wasn't his shining hour, you know, leading like that. He did, of course, as president, get on a horse with a brace of pistols and ride to the Battle of Bladensburg, and which was dumb. And, you know, everybody said, what are you doing here? Get out of here. We're about to lose. But, you know, at least he had the guts to do it. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so Madison snitched my Steve Barry question. The second book, I think it's called The Patriot Threat, was about slavery. But it's the same principle, and it's fiction. So here's just a softball. What is the ice house? Did they really cut the ice in the winter, and it stayed?
Yes. You know, our icon is the temple, right, the form of the temple. And below the temple is a 25-foot-deep pit. And so the temple actually provides shade for that pit, and that's the ice house. And they would. If you've been to Montpelier and you go to the temple and you look down the hill, off the backside of the house, you'll see a small pond there. That was actually created by the DuPonts. But in Madison's time, it would have been very easy to take the stream that ran through that area. What you would do is you would create a level piece of ground with very finely mown grass, let the sheep on it for a week, and just get it down to nothing. And then you would dam up a creek to try to get 3 or 4 inches of water on top of that grass, and then let it freeze, and then go break it up, take it up to the ice house, dump it in the hole. It wasn't like a New England ice house where you had the blocks of ice. It's not like the Frozen movie, you know, where they're chopping it out of the pond. But you would just create the biggest snowball, you know, in Virginia that you could underground, and that snowball would stay frozen through the summer. And anytime you wanted it, you would go down literally with a hatchet and chop a hunk of ice off of it and bust it up and either serve cold drinks or make cold desserts. And, of course, that provided refrigeration for fresh meat.
Sorry, since there's time, I'm fascinated. I mean, I've been to Montpelier and so forth, but when the DuPonts had it, they had built so much stuff around that core.
Yeah.
Those wings there were still intact underneath all that stuff?
Yeah, the lion's share of it was. The DuPonts, like I said, they kind of like built a shell, you know, a turtle shell over the turtle. And so they went up over top of the wings 2 stories. They created, where the roof is on Montpelier in this image, they created an entire 3rd story in there that was all the servants' quarters. And then they created enormous additions that went off the back of the house, and they made more additions that went down the hill in this direction that were connected to the house. But you know, 99% of the Madison's home was still there. It may have been moved around. Like, windows were bricked up and doors were bricked up and new holes were cut for entryways and stuff. For instance, the DuPonts took all of the 19th century windows out of the first floor because they were old. But they didn't throw them away. They put them into the servants' quarters on the third floor. So when we started tearing those out, you know, we said, well, those aren't 20th century windows. Those are 19th century windows. And then they could actually figure out where each window went in the old house. I mean, it was really remarkable detective work during the restoration. It was a lot of fun to be part of. There, I mean, there were just new discoveries every day in those years. That was just remarkable to be part of.
A simple question. We have with you and others like you a recall of an age that is very important, but this began most recently. I don't remember anything like this when I was a student.
I don't know how to address that.
Address it by saying it was in the hands of the DuPont, so we didn't have access.
Well, that's true, yeah. I mean, Montpelier was a private residence.
I asked because one of my students in a private school in New England was a DuPont girl.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're a big family. They're all, you never know when there's going to be a DuPont in the room. But yeah, it was a private residence from 1765 when his father built it until 1984. And then there was a 3-year period between 84 and 87 where it was kind of in limbo in the hands of the lawyers. And then it opened to the public in 1987. But it was a great big empty house for the most part for the first 15 years or so. And it wasn't until the late 90s that things really started to take shape inside the mansion. And then the restoration was really the game changer in 2004.
The one that gave the foundation so much trouble, the DuPont man who said it was his house.
Yeah.
Was he the same one who murdered some people?
No. 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 Marion's brother was Willie DuPont, and his son was the one up in Pennsylvania that the movie's just come out about. Unrelated to the cousins, I guess they would have been, of Marion's, who were unhappy with the transfer of the estate to the trust. One more. Okay, one more.
I'm interested. You showed the room with this orange-red color.
Yes.
Is that picked from the new theory that we have to have bright colored walls, or was this the true wall color?
It's great. That room, really interesting, it was the only room in the mansion that retained its Madison-era plaster, so we didn't pull the plaster out of that room. And as they were doing the architectural investigations and they were looking up under the architrave, the crown molding, they actually found a tiny little scrap of the original wallpaper. And it's microscopic, you know, but they were able to put it under a microscope and get the color, which is that crimson. The picture didn't really do it justice, but it's a crimson red. And it has a wool flocking on it. So they would take a wood block and with a pattern on it, and they would layer it with glue and press it on the paper, and then they would sprinkle ground wool on top of the glue that gave it sort of texture. And so we were able to, we didn't know the pattern of the texture, but we you know, used an educated guess to decide on the pattern. So that's pretty darn close to being as authentic as it comes. Yeah. Yeah. And every room has a story like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.